Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawane. It's estimated that tens of millions of Americans suffer from chronic pain. Opioids such as OxyContin and Percocet have been freely prescribed to treat chronic pain over the last decades. But opioids can be highly addictive, and there is now a growing crisis in which hundreds of thousands of people across the country struggle with such addiction, in addition to their pain. And some of them risk death from opioid overdose. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have just given physicians new guidelines which recommend big changes in the way opioids are prescribed. In this hour, we'll talk about what this means for doctors and patients. Also, we'll attempt to define pain and the alternatives available to treat it. Our guests this hour include Jean Marie Perrone, professor of emergency medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. She is also director of the Division of Medical Toxicology in the Department of Emergency Medicine there. Jean Marie, nice to have you on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Michael Ashburn is director of the Penn Pain Medicine Center at the University of Pennsylvania and professor of anesthesiology and critical care at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Sure. So let's begin by getting a brief primer on how opioids work in the body to relieve pain. Michael?
Opioids actually are very effective for the treatment of certain types of pain. They work on opioid receptors that are within the body. And when administered for sudden new onset acute pain, they can be quite effective. What I mean by that is the pain that comes after trauma or surgery. Those medications can be incredibly important for relieving pain out in those conditions. The problem arises in that opioids often lose their effect over time. And as a result, a fewer number of patients experience good pain control when the medications are used for long periods of time.
So if they don't work after long periods of time, then do you need a higher dose to get the same effect?
You do. But the problem is that there's increased risk of harm as the dose is increased over time. And there's a concept called differential tolerance, which means that patients become tolerant to the pain-relieving effects of the medications most quickly, and they become tolerant to the adverse effects on breathing less quickly. So as the dose is increased in order to try to get people more pain control, they're actually at increased risk of dying from the side effects from the medication.
When do physical and emotional dependence begin to set in?
That's an excellent question. There used to be a thought that only patients who took these medications for long periods of time were at risk for substance use disorder or addiction. And in fact, that's not true. Many patients can develop addiction from these medications when they're exposed to them for short periods of time.
Such as how long?
Such as for hours or days. Mm. But the risk of harm certainly seems to increase when the medications are used for long periods of time.
Jean Marie, back in the 90s, opioids weren't prescribed as much, were they? Who were they meant for back then, and what changed?
So when I was in medical school, it was unusual to prescribe these medications from an emergency department visit for situations like acute pain. If there was a fracture or a more severe injury, it would be appropriate. But most of these medicines were reserved for cancer patients and patients in a post-operative period. But few patients went home on these as a result of an acute painful episode, much less commonly than today.
What changed?
I think doctors were given advice to be more liberal with treating pain, and rather than making more attention to pain management equal any kind of pain management, ice, elevation, acetaminophen, Motrin, medicines like that, the equivalent parameter was we need to prescribe more opioids in order to more acutely treat pain. And that misperception is part of what's led us to where we are now.
And was there an understanding at the time of how addictive these medicines are?
So for a long time, thousands of years, we've known that derivatives of the opium or poppy plant were addictive. There's been wars cast over opium trade. So people knew for a long time. There was a new change in the way these drugs were marketed to physicians, where there was an idea that if you had such severe pain, you couldn't get addicted if you were treated with opioids. And we know that's completely not true now. So there's been an awakening and an awareness in the general physician and patient population, but we need to expand that awareness so people have appropriate concern about using these medications as widely as they have been used in the past.
Michael, as we mentioned earlier, you're the director of the Penn Pain Medical Center. Pain can be so subjective. How do you determine what sort of pain a patient is in?
Well, I think that's a very important part. And even in pain that many physicians think is relatively straightforward, such as pain after an operation, the underlying causes of the patient's distress can be varied, and it's not always what we call nociception or activation of the pain pathways in the body. And patients can relate their overall distress in terms of pain, and opioids are not always the right answer when people are expressing distress in terms of pain.
No, people just want the pain to be gone. And I'm assuming, say, give me whatever it takes to get rid of this pain.
That's exactly right. And that actually is one of the challenges when dealing with chronic pain, is that in our society, the hope and expectation by patients who come to see us is that I have a magic pill or a magic procedure that I can do to make their pain go away. And in fact, a better way of thinking about chronic pain is diabetes. It's a chronic disease state that needs to be managed, and that a cure, like appendicitis is a different model, may not necessarily be available in many of those people.
So what you're saying then is perhaps with a less addictive therapy, you're still going to have some pain, but you can manage the pain. You might not be able to make all the pain go away?
That is correct. And one of the things that's important is that the mainstay of chronic pain, the treatments that have been identified as being the most effective, is something called interdisciplinary care. That includes the use of medications, sometimes including opioids, but not always, activating physical therapy, both on the land and in water therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a combination of education and relaxation and self-management techniques, as well as injection therapy or advanced pain therapies. All those therapies done in combination when appropriate are the most effective way of achieving long-term improvements in pain control.
And this is essentially one of the CDC recommendations.
Correct? Yes, that is correct.
Try these alternative therapies. I'd read, Jean Marie, that as many as 100 million Americans suffer from chronic pain. Why so many of us?
Well, I guess my theory might be that a lot of people have been started on various medications that have, instead of allowing the pain to heal or the condition to heal, but to make, in some cases, people more focused on the pain or focused on pain relief. And this idea that a pain score, a score of 10 out of 10 pain, should be relieved to 0 out of 10. So there's a new movement to understand that we can't expect zero pain as a number on a pain score, and that really some more manageable number of pain and tolerance of that more manageable number is a more reasonable goal.
And that 0 to 10 scale doesn't really talk about, perhaps, say, tissue damage. It's just the actual injury or whatever the patient's dealing with. It's really just a measure of their pain.
It's a measure of the patient's pain report. Pain intensity cannot be measured like blood pressure can be measured, so we rely on the patient to be able to tell us how they're doing. When we're treating chronic pain, we ask for a patient to tell us what their pain intensity is. We also ask them about how much relief they're getting from the pain treatment modalities, as well as obtaining measures of physical and mental functioning. And one of the things that we see, which is quite interesting to me, is that patients will report that they are better from the therapy, but pain intensity report is actually the last thing to change, because frequently patients will report pain relief and they will trade pain relief for improvements in physical functioning. They'll find that it's valuable for them to be able to get off the couch, be able to take care of themselves, to interact with their family members, and to do other things that get them value. And indeed, they will trade pain for that ability to do other things.
Let's get back to the CDC guidelines for physicians, the new guidelines, which I believe came out in March. Another recommendation is that when opioids are prescribe the lowest possible dose for the shortest amount of time. And this even goes into the hospital with surgery. So I my understanding is some surgeons are saying, wait a minute, 3 days for this particular procedure? So what is the pushback there?
I think that there's a lot of good thinking behind those numbers. We know that chronic pain and the prescribing of opioids for chronic pain has led to a vast oversupply of opioids that then get diverted as they're left behind in medicine cabinets. So one of the ideas of less prescribing of specific numbers of pills helps us focus on, you know, the pills and the prescriptions that are left over. And if you ask a group of people in the community, you know, what for the last surgery you had, how many did you take? People will say 4 or 5 or less than 10 most often. And where are the rest of those pills? And most people scratch their head and say, I think they're in my medicine cabinet in case I have pain in the future.
I was just going to say, save it for another problem.
But what we know is that teenagers and other young adults are getting into those medicines, or they're being diverted or sold. And it's that vast oversupply that has allowed so many young people to try these pain medicines for something that would otherwise be relieved with acetaminophen or aspirin or Motrin. So we're really hoping that decreasing the supply will decrease the opportunities for diversion and more people getting exposed to these drugs in an inappropriate way.
And so if you have these in your cabinet, get rid of them.
Yes. There are prescription take-back days. The DEA has organized events like that. Usually a lot of communities will host an event like that, and it's really an important opportunity to decrease the supply as well as doctors decreasing their prescribing.
So again, back to prescribing a lower dose for a shorter amount of time for the patients who are already on opioids. And some doctors, I understand, have prescribed, you know, refill prescriptions. Now, what is the doctor, what is that conversation looking like? I have to lower your dosage. We should pull you off of these. And how are the patients reacting?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. One of the issues that we found in a recent survey is half the patients who are on chronic opioids did not get there by a specific decision to provide opioids to that patient as part of a comprehensive pain program. Rather, those patients were prescribed opioids for an injury or an illness and then just kept getting refills, and they evolved to receiving chronic opioids. And 1/4 of those patients who are on chronic opioids started opioids for a purpose or a pain other than the one that they're currently receiving opioids for. So one of the key things that physicians need to do is carefully evaluate whether the patient needs chronic opioids and whether they're clearly benefiting from them. Because clearly, whether it's an antihypertension medication or an opioid, patients should not be taking any medication unless it's clearly showing benefit. And that benefit outweighs the risk of harm that patients can have from taking those medications.
And quickly, before we go to the break, the signs of addiction. If you are addicted, what do you look for?
Well, one of the things that's important is that risk of harm with opioids doesn't only come with addiction. We talk a lot about addiction because it's a very important part of the issue that we're talking about. But people also can die from sleep disordered breathing. They have cognitive effects and other problems with these medications.
All right, we'll get to more of that in just a moment after the break. We are chatting with Michael Ashburn, director of the Penn Pain Medical Center, also Jean Marie Perrone, professor of emergency medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Opioids, the focus this hour, 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowane. More in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. The federal government is trying to get a handle on the epidemic of opioid abuse in this country, so there are new guidelines out for doctors who prescribe medicines such as OxyContin and Vicodin. We're talking about that this hour with Jean Marie Perrone, professor of emergency medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Division of Medical Toxicology in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And Michael Ashburn is head of the Penn Pain Medical Center at the University of Pennsylvania and also professor of anesthesiology and critical care at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. If you have comments or questions, here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet as well at WHYY Radio Times. And going into the break, we were talking about how there are other effects from opioids. And my understanding is that you've got the opioid epidemic here and also the obesity epidemic. And sometimes the two dovetail with deadly result. Michael, could you get into that for us?
Well, one of the issues is that as people get more obese, there's increased risk of developing something called obstructive sleep apnea. And in a large number of patients, obstructive sleep apnea is actually not diagnosed. They have it, but it's not diagnosed and is not treated. And opioids affect breathing in very important ways. And when combined with untreated obstructive sleep apnea, there's a significant risk of death. Many of us believe that the risk of harm with opioids, the death rate, is actually an underestimation of the true death rate, because many of our patients may be dying in their sleep. And if grandma who's 80 dies in her sleep, we may not be putting it together that we contributed to that by sleep disorder breathing, which is made worse with the prescriptions of opioids.
And are there also questions about opioids in use with other drugs that the patient might be taking? And are doctors, is everybody informed?
We believe that more people are becoming informed is the potential risk. And for instance, the risk of death doubles when benzodiazepines, Valium-like medications, are prescribed with chronic opioid therapy. And when combined with high-dose opioid therapy, the risk is astronomical. And that's one of the challenges that we have in recognizing which patients may be at risk for harm and then balancing the potential for benefit, which is actually relatively modest with chronic opioids for chronic pain.
So, Jean Marie, let's go to the ER. How much opioid abuse do you see in the ER?
It'd be hard to come up with an exact number for opioid abuse. We do see many of our patients chronically taking opioids. So we might see patients who have run out and they're presenting complaint in the emergency department is an exacerbation of their abdominal pain. And you may start a new evaluation with new blood work and a new CAT scan looking to see if there's some new process going on. When at the end of it all, you know, there isn't anything new, it's just that they actually have recently run out of their opioid pain management that was controlling those symptoms. So we see a lot of that, or even that they're still on the same dose and now need a higher dose of the medicine. So that's one component of what we're seeing. We also see a lot of patients who were on opioids who are now have transitioned to heroin because of an exposure to these drugs as a for a pain management issue and now are using heroin instead. So we see lots of overdoses of both opioids, prescription opioids, as well as heroin.
As it's becoming increasingly difficult to obtain opioid prescriptions?
Yes. I mean, it's a combination of a change in availability, but also because these drugs were so available to young people to try, there might have been an appropriate amount of concern for using heroin or having the stigma of using injection drugs. But because that transition has been changed by trying opioids in pill form first, then perhaps trying insufflation or snorting those pills, and then, you know, saying I'll never try heroin, and then trying heroin by the same technique of snorting it and then going on to injection drug use. So that spiral is unfortunate. We're seeing it much more commonly.
Do you see, is there less prescribing of opioids in the ER for emergency situations since the CDC guidelines came out?
So I would say we absolutely have had an increased awareness for about 5 or 6 years. About 5 years ago, a study came out in the Journal of American Medical Association about emergency physicians being the top 5 prescribers of opioids by numbers of prescriptions. And so I think that led to an increased awareness by emergency physicians that we need to sort of reevaluate our practice. And gradually over time, we've had a decrease in the number of prescriptions. We've also had, we've always known that we wrote a lot of prescriptions, but not for large quantities. So on a recent evaluation in a study we did, we actually found that the average prescription from the emergency department was only for about 15 pills. So while we write a lot, we try to pay more attention to the quantity and have a risk-benefit discussion with the patient beforehand.
And then that goes to the primary care physician.
Yes.
Is there a good conversation going on between ER and primary care doc? Is there a follow-through?
In a big health system like where we work, we can have more facilitated discussions if the patient is followed in our health system. If not, it's one of the challenges of emergency medicine in terms of trying to have those communications on nights and weekends and being able to clarify that transition.
All right. We got a tweet from Jay who says, this discussion should begin with addiction. Chronic pain management should come at the end. I'm not quite sure where Jay is coming from with that, but I guess they're so interrelated. We really should, again, perhaps outline what addiction looks like. And if you are on opioid medication, and you feel yourself sliding into a way, a place where you shouldn't be, what are the signs? What are the red flags, Michael?
Well, when we're taking care of patients who are on chronic opioids, we actually try to do careful monitoring of ongoing therapy. And that includes carefully looking at the patient's response to opioids so the opioids are not continued if they're not actually helpful. We also look for side effects. Side effects include what we call broadly aberrant drug-related behavior, which may also include substance use disorder. For a physician standpoint, we regularly obtain urine drug screens, and we're looking for the presence of the medication that we're prescribing and the absence of medications that are not being prescribed, including illegal drugs. We also look for changes in behavior that may demonstrate that the patient is getting themselves into trouble, including requests for early refills, reports of lost medications, and more seriously, evidence that they're forging their prescription or modifying the prescription in some way, that they're engaged in illegal behavior. One of the key things when we talk about addiction as a separate topic is that addiction is a serious health disorder in America, and it deserves diagnosis and it deserves treatment. There's improper stigma related to substance use disorders in America. Patients who have substance use disorders are deserving of a proper diagnosis, and they're certainly deserving of proper therapy. And one of the challenges that physicians have is identifying the disorder. That's one step. But even more importantly, getting them into proper treatment.
All right, let's get to the phones. Newark, Delaware, and Greg. Hi, Greg. Welcome to Radio Times.
How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Hi. Oh, thank you. I'm a chronic pain sufferer. I'm only a 43-year-old male, but I have degenerative disc disease. Lost two discs already, been replaced with the third one already blown out once. I have gone through everything, physical therapy, pain management, right now continuing on with chiropractic to try to get back function. However, my biggest issue has been that as you have been basically transitioning away from opioids for pain management, it is becoming increasingly difficult to get any kind of pain management. When they refer me to a pain specialist, it's a minimum of 3 to 6 weeks so I can finally get in. Ibuprofen is definitely not an answer because after maintaining high levels, it starts doing other deleterious effects as well as the pressure on the kidneys. So, and I have been finding treatment options rarer and rarer, and pain management becomes harder and harder. So I am not alone with this.
Greg, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. This leaves him in the lurch, essentially, is what we were hearing from him and the producer.
I think actually he makes an excellent point, is that to some degree, we've devolved to chronic opioid therapy, and we've created the problem that we're facing with a large generation of people who are reliant only on opioids as a treatment option. There's lots of different reasons why that happened, but much of it is due to inadequate access to proper care. The interdisciplinary care methodologies that I described before, psychological care, cognitive behavioral therapy, activating physical therapy, appropriate use of interventions and non-opioid medications, perhaps combined with opioids, is far more effective and actually very, very hard to gain access to.
I was going to say, are you going to find avenues through the typical primary care doc's office to those therapies?
No, because many of the pain programs find barriers to giving their patients that care. There are many of the common large healthcare insurance companies, for instance, in southeast Pennsylvania that don't allow the patient to see our pain psychologist. They have specific carve-outs for psychological care, so they aren't allowed to see the pain psychologist who's most likely to be able to provide the care that they need.
So enormously frustrating for the person who might be suffering from chronic pain, knows they need to move away from opioids, but can't access the proper care. All right, let's go to Mindy in Reading. You are live on Radio Times. Hello, Mindy.
Good morning. I'm calling because I'm somebody who has been on pain medication now for many years. I'm 60 years old. My initial diagnosis was when I was 17, and I have been taking opioids for a very long time. And like any other maintenance medication, we could talk about, you know, being addicted to thyroid medication as well. But not everybody who is on opioids displays addictive behavior. And I think there needs to be a discussion about the difference between a physical dependency and addiction.
Are they two different things? Dependency and addiction.
Somebody is physically dependent on thyroid medication. Somebody is physically dependent on something for diabetes. Where is the difference?
Mindy, thank you for the call. Dependency versus addiction.
I think it's an excellent point, and it's a very important point in that people become dependent on a medication. Dependence is essentially defined as when a medication is abruptly discontinued, they have withdrawal. That is not the same as addiction, and she makes an excellent point that taking a medication chronically, whether it's steroids or whether it's opioids, the body gets used to those medications, and abrupt discontinuation of the medication will cause harm. Addiction, from an anesthesiologist's point of view, could be simply defined as continuing to do something even though you know it's hurting yourself. And, of course, the most common drug that people are addicted to in America is tobacco, where anybody – there used to be a joke that anybody with an IQ over room temperature knows that smoking a cigarette is bad for them. Mm. And that would meet that broad definition of addiction. Many people can and do benefit from chronic opioid therapy.
So for over long periods of
time. Over long periods of time. The key is identifying which ones do and which ones don't, so we can do proper selection of patients and proper monitoring so they get the care that they need. But those who are not benefiting from the care or, in fact, who are suffering from side effects can get into proper therapy.
All right. And as this conversation has been evolving, Jean Marie, a relatively new opioid called Zohydro is on the market, and it offers, well, tell us what it does. It offers long-lasting relief. And you, by the way, were on the FDA advisory committee, which voted against the approval of Zohydro.
That's right. So Zohydro was going to offer a long-acting hydrocodone, much like the long-acting oxycodone, which is present in OxyContin. Many people were concerned that OxyContin was the start of this epidemic. So our concerns when Zohydro or hydrocodone long-acting was actually evaluated by the FDA was that hydrocodone in the form of Vicodin comes with acetaminophen in it. And so as an adjunct pain reliever, acetaminophen with hydrocodone in small doses, 5 and 10 milligrams, didn't offer the large volume of opioid without acetaminophen. So when you go from that to hydrocodone in a long-acting high-dose formulation, 30 milligrams, 60 milligrams, you allow another drug to come on the market in large volumes with a big dose that could potentially be abused. And we didn't see an opportunity for or a need for a new drug like that.
And also it didn't have any safeguards against misuse.
Exactly. So abuse deterrent formulations are another goal of the Food and Drug Administration. Abuse deterrent formulations do prevent the insufflation or injection of those drugs, but it doesn't prevent people from continuing to use them orally to have that same euphoria that some people get from these drugs. So it does prevent some diversion and misuse, but it doesn't prevent all diversion and misuse. So those are not a panacea for the problem we have.
How is Zohydro selling?
So not very well. It hasn't been prescribed as much as people had expected what was predicted.
Is it because of the pushback, do you think?
Well, I hope there was a message associated with, you know, an advisory committee of potentially of experts being concerned about using the drug and voting against it.
Let's get to the pharmaceutical industry for a moment. It's a pretty powerful lobby. What role do you think the industry plays in getting approval for drugs that might be questionable? And what does the dialogue look like when it comes to getting drugs pulled or reduced in scope? Michael?
Well, certainly pharmaceutical industry takes the lead in getting drugs approved. They have a branded product. They expect to make a profit. That's the reason that they're in business for the product. And hopefully legitimate pharmaceutical companies are trying to develop products that add value to the healthcare system and have some value for the healthcare environment. Removing a drug from the market is actually quite complex and very rarely done. One of the key things is physician prescribing. These drugs do indeed have value. The problem with opioids is that we're not very good at the moment on carefully identifying which patients will benefit from the medication, on monitoring patients for development of problems, and then stopping the medication when we see those problems develop.
Are physicians being educated about opioids now in med school?
That's a great question. Michael and I are involved in a new search for ways to optimize curriculum at many different medical schools, including our own. And Michael has put together a survey to inventory the students about how comfortable they feel with the prescribing education that they get. So I think it's an opportunity to improve both in med school, in residency, and young graduates and older graduates. We all need help in identifying. And as he said, it's hard to even take on this task of screening patients or changing the practices that they're already been exposed to. So we need work in this area. The CDC guidelines definitely help, though.
Let's get to the doctor's office. I mean, physicians have a working relationship with pharmaceutical reps, and, you know, doctors are updated on new drugs, dosage use, et cetera. How much influence does this relationship have on physicians regarding what is prescribed? Is that something that needs to change?
I think the potential for improper impact on physician practices certainly exists. Now, Penn for years has had actually a very aggressive policy that tries to eliminate that, and that we, all faculty, are required to report financial relationships with industry, and we are precluded from having any interaction with industry with regard to promotion of their products. There's strict limits on our ability or our the conditions in which we interact with representatives. At the Pain Center at University of Pennsylvania, like most of the programs, we don't have pharmaceutical representatives coming and doing lunches or doing any sorts of visit. And we strictly limit that interaction in an attempt to make sure that we don't have undue influence of the industry on our practice.
So changing recommendations regarding, say, opioid prescribing might not be a difficult conversation then. Yeah. Okay, we're coming up against a break. We will continue our conversation regarding opioids and changes in federal government rules regarding physician prescription and et cetera. Michael Ashburn is director of the Penn Pain Medical Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Jean Marie Perrone is professor of emergency medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Calls are coming in to 888-477-9499. Hope you'll join us back in a moment. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscoane. The federal government is trying to get a handle on the epidemic of opioid abuse in this country. There are new guidelines out for doctors who prescribe such medicines, and we are talking about that this hour of Radio Times. Our guests include Jean Marie Perrone, professor of emergency medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and Michael Ashburn is director of the Penn Pain Medical Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And the number to call if you have questions or comments, 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org. And let's get to those phones. Dan in Cherry Hill, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a family physician in New Jersey, and I suspect I'm older than any of your panel members. When I was in medical school, it was considered the height of bad practice to prescribe opiates for anything because of fear of addiction. And as I was a young physician, the new thought and new perspective was to be more patient-friendly and to treat pain whenever we could. And what I'm pointing out here is that, you know, part of this tension between, you know, overuse and underuse has been a tension in medicine for decades. And we go through cycles of more concern about one end of things and one more of the other. One of the things that helped the patient-friendly increased use of pain medication of the opiate class was the long-acting opiates. And there was a large body of literature at the time, which has informed my practice ever since, that you could not become psychologically addicted or impaired mentally or psychologically using the appropriate long-acting medication of this type that created a steady state of blood level in the body, and the brain essentially would tune out the high.
Is that the case?
That is my clinical impression with having been using these medications. I never use a Percocet, but I'm much more happy using even a very low dose of a long-acting medication, even for a relatively short period of time, because I know addiction can occur within hours or days. I agree with your panel there.
Dan, can you hang on for 1 second? I'd like to get reaction from our guests on the tendency toward dependency in the brain if you're using long-acting opiates. If a person's on them for a long time, do we now know that there is more of a chance of dependency?
There was a recent publication by substance use disorder experts that emphasized that fast-on, fast-off medications do tend to be more interesting to people who are genetically predisposed to addiction. So I would actually agree with the statement that short-acting, fast-on, fast-off drugs that get to the brain very quickly are likely to be more interesting with two people who have a tendency to have addiction disorders and may likely trigger this sort of response that's seen. But long-acting opioids are not a free pass and indeed can create some of the problems. And is what you see in the CDC guidelines. CDC guidelines actually recommend that physicians, when they're using opioids, focus on the short-acting opioids and avoid giving the long-acting opioids because the safety data would say that long-acting opioids tend to be more associated with overdose and death.
Interesting. Then they should probably be more on the lookout then with the short-acting opioids for addiction than in their patients.
Many of our patients, in my clinical practice, the most common drug that people are requesting when they come in and specifically request an opioid is oxycodone.
So, Dan, first of all, have you folded the CDC recommendations into your practice, the recommendations regarding opioid prescription? And if so, what is the reaction from your patients?
Well, first of all, after having done something for 30 years and find it works, the people who come to my practice are looking to get Vicodin and Percocet and often say, I want this, because that's what gets them off. That's what gets them high. I've never had people asking for higher doses of long-acting opiates when we've gotten to the level that controls their pain. I have had people come off of that, and I've even had people, in one particular case, a gentleman with bad osteoarthritis was able to become so active that essentially he was able to cure his bad chronic osteoarthritis, which had disabled him, because he became so physically able, and we all know that that helps arthritis. It was actually pain-free and able to go off the medication of that incident after a couple of years of that type of use.
So you're not expanding to alternative therapies? That was one of the recommendations?
Absolutely. Everything from acupuncture to even herbal alternatives are part of my practice. So it's a very small number of people who have the type of pain I need to use these medications for. But it hasn't been my experience that the long actings lead to psychological habituation. The only chronic symptom that they typically create is constipation, which is an easily handled area.
Hey, Dan, thank you so much. We're running a little short on time, and we do need to get to some other callers, but we really appreciate the insights you brought to our show. Thank you. Let's go to Liz in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Liz.
Hi, thanks for having this discussion today. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I have a question, and that is, because opiates and heroin, as an effect, is debilitating our community so badly, I'm wondering what kind of conversations are being had about pain management that's non-opiate-based.
We talked about that a little bit, and from what I'm seeing on the screen, you were in the ER last week, and you told the docs in the text that you wanted a non-opioid. Jean Marie, is that something that is now part of the conversation in your emergency room?
Yes, I hope so. I think that one of the things that the CDC focused on was chronic pain guidelines, but what I think we really need is acute pain guidelines, which means that in your emergency department visit, you're first offered a pain reliever like acetaminophen, perhaps even in the triage area before we have any other information about you, and then possibly a ibuprofen or a non-steroidal. These medicines are extremely effective for almost all kinds of pain and should be the first-line therapy, even in a patient who comes to the emergency department. What's thwarted this a little bit is that, as physicians, we think because those meds are over-the-counter and the patient's coming to the emergency department, maybe they've already tried them. But we rarely ask, and so we you know, we end up with this idea that we need to prescribe something that's prescription strength or that's stronger. And so part of the education that we've been doing is starting with these therapies, you know, immediately. And people find that their pain relief is you know, adequate, that they're comfortable going home on reasonable over-the-counter medications.
Yeah, thanks,
that's
Liz.
A great point.
Thanks, Liz, for the call to Radio Times. Is there enough time typically for physicians to have these rather broad-based conversations with their patients? It seems as if they're quite often up against the clock.
A colleague of both of ours, I think, once said that it takes, you know, 30 seconds to write a prescription and 30 minutes to explain why you're not going to write a prescription.
Yeah.
So it's a real challenge. But hopefully, I think for people who are focusing on acute pain and knowing that acute pain treated with opioids often leads to chronic pain, even of a different type, we need to really be judicious with that first prescription. So I'm not worried about the patients who are on these medicines for years. That's a challenge for not the emergency department. Our challenges are really focusing on new injuries, new acute pain, and how can we treat acute pain so that it doesn't result in chronic pain.
Okay. We've got an email from Dorothy. She says, as a patient with advanced stage 4 metastatic colon cancer, I've been frustrated by the fact that the only pain relief offered to me are opioids. I've declined them and suffer from severe pain, and I'm repeatedly urged to take the drugs. I tell them masking the pain is not the same thing as dealing with the cause. I want natural options but do not have insurance that will cover this. I feel the medical profession is sorely lacking. She is a person for whom the opioids would typically be normally be prescribed. What is out there for somebody who's suffering severe pain on you know, a constant level?
Well, one of the things that she's pointing out is this is cancer-related pain, and we do think of cancer-related pain, particularly in individuals who have advanced cancer, in a completely different light, where controlling the pain, not masking the pain, we actually think of it as controlling the pain is actually important. Active treatment, effective treatment of pain in individuals with cancer actually helps them live longer, even absent any other type of therapy that helps them. And opioids are an important part of the therapy that's done for that. The non-opioid therapy that we've talked about before, including non-opioid medications, the cognitive behavioral therapy, the relaxation, meditation, are also effective for the treatment of cancer pain and can be used in combination with opioids when prescribed properly.
Are there disparities in the way pain is managed among the poor in comparison with the middle and the upper classes?
I mean, I work in the emergency department, so we see everybody,
yeah.
and I'm happy to say that we don't have you know, occasion to have those kinds of findings. I do think that people who don't have access to a primary care doctor to get the follow-up they need, we do see more of them in the emergency department in these situations. But I also think that everyone needs education. I think it's all demographics that have expectations that opioids are the first line therapy. And so I think to some extent there's literature to say that the, you know, different demographics have actually suffered more because of their increased exposure to these medications. It's a challenge.
All right, let's get back to the calls. Ariel in Ardmore, Pennsylvania. You're live on Radio Times.
Hi. I have a question. I'm a social worker, and I was wondering about the use of genograms in deciding whether to prescribe opioids or not. I found, generally speaking, that I feel part of the problem is lack of relationships between patients and physicians. And, yeah, that's it.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, first of all, what's a genogram?
I'm not sure if she's talking about genetic metabolism pathways that might affect perhaps drugs like codeine and different metabolites. Some people are very rapid metabolizers and may get a higher dose of an active metabolite of codeine, and some people would get less. But otherwise, I'm not quite sure. Maybe she could tell us what a genogram is.
Are you still there?
Yes, I am. No, genogram is looking at the family tree from a different perspective, a medical perspective, so seeing if there's addictions in the family. We use that in suicides as well, when there's a tendency in families, if there's or divorce, if there's used to be suicide in the family, then you can see that repeat.
Sure.
So, So that's how we use that.
That's an interesting question. I wonder whether first of all, what do you think, and whether the information would be readily accessible to the typical primary care physician?
Well, the Pennsylvania guidelines on how to prescribe opioids for chronic non-cancer pain, as well as the CDC guidelines, emphasize the need for a physician to do proper screening. And one of the key things is identifying people who are at increased risk of harm. And from a substance use disorder or overdose, that includes the patient's sex, i.e. young men, are more likely to overdose and die when chronic opioids are prescribed than any other group. And a personal family history of any sort of substance use disorder, including alcohol or other drugs other than opioids, put them at significant increased risk of harm. Mental illness, particularly PTSD, ADHD, and depression, also place people at increased risk of harm. So it's important for providers to indeed screen the patient and identify whether or not they're at increased risk of harm. And as she's mentioned, a strong family history of a disruptive family environment where other individuals within the family, particularly those with which the patient lives, is having active substance use disorders where the medications may be diverted is certainly an issue that should be concerning and should be considered when thinking about prescribing these medications.
Thanks, Ariel. We've got time for one more call. That's Steve in Center City. Welcome, Steve.
Hi. I'm a pain management physician myself, and I just want to make two points. The first one is regards to physician education, and I'm glad that Dr. Prohn and Dr. Ashman are studying this. But it's been a problem that we've known about for at least 30 years. In fact, I co-authored a paper that was published 25 years ago showing how little education primary care docs received in pain management. So we keep reinventing the wheel, but we've done very, very little about it in all that time to actually improve physician education. So that's a major problem. The second point that I think your guests have touched on is just to reemphasize that opioids are not always the optimal analgesic.
Yeah.
For many types of pains, including such common ones as fibromyalgia, diabetic neuropathic pain, and even many types of cancer pain, the non-opioids such as the SNRIs, antidepressants, and anticonvulsants are much more efficacious than the opioids are.
I think you're preaching to the choir here, Steve.
Okay. Finally, I just want to mention, Dr. Pearl mentioned about the needs for a government guideline on acute pain. She may be too young to know that in the early 1990s, in fact, the federal government, the Department of HHS, did issue pain guidelines on acute pain management. I know because I was one of the people who wrote it. So I know about that. And in fact, most of what's said in those guidelines are still just as pertinent today and just as applicable today as they were when they were written those many years ago. So we keep rewriting these things and we keep doing the same things over and over again. Unfortunately, pain doesn't get very much better managed over all these years.
Thank you, Steve, so much for the call to Radio Times. So, and one more quick question about warnings. The FDA is soon going to require new warnings, black box cautions regarding opioids. How many patients really read those black box warnings?
I don't think it has a big influence initially, but I do think that physician prescribers, the funny/ironic thing maybe is that when these drugs came out, there weren't any mention of addiction as a big problem. So we really need to go back on a prescriber level and a patient level and remind people that these drugs have huge risks and that we need to have caution. So any time that message can get out helps us.
More work to be done. Well,
yes.
That's about it for this hour. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jean Marie Prohn, professor of emergency medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Division of Medical Toxicology in the Department of Emergency Medicine there, and Michael Ashburn, director of the Penn Pain Medical Center at the University of Pennsylvania and professor of anesthesiology and critical care at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And as always, if you have a moment, visit our Facebook page. Also, check out our podcast. Simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times.